Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, and today I'm joined by what was once called in our office when we had an office, the Ministry of Truth, Mr. Marius Roux. Marius, how are you? How's Benoni? How's life?
How's Nick? How's Terence? Managed to get my laptop camera fixed so people can stare at my glorious visage.
Excellent. Well, we'll leave it up to the audience to decide what level of glorious it is.
Can't tell you how that's made my day.
But good to see you again. And of course, the undefeated Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you?
It's a bit chillous today, hey? But otherwise,
Yeah.
I'm surviving.
It is a gray, dark, cloudy day in Joburg, at least, and I suspect across much of the north of the country. And it is very cold, which seems sort of fitting because we are seeing a sort of drama play out with this conflict between Zuma and the ANC, which looks increasingly like they might maybe do something about him, but we don't know yet. And isn't it wonderful that we have to sit and wait for party political meetings to decide whether they're going to enforce the law or not? Anyway, we shall continue to watch that. But let us talk about the ANC in a different way today. And we're taking an interesting article here from, I think it might have originally been the Sunday Times, but it was hosted on Times Live. And it's quite a long thing, but it's an investigation into South Africa's newest MP, Dr. Xiaomei Harvard, who is, I think, possibly the only Chinese-born MP in the ANC. I'm not sure about that. But anyway, there are some people in the ANC who have accused her of donating to the party to buy her seat in parliament. When asked by reporters whether how much she gives to the ANC, she says about 2 to 4 million over the past 5 or 6 years. She was born in China, and she's a says that she's a big supporter of the ANC and that she's given lots of money to the party and that she's done lots of community work for the ANC in the Chinese community. But there are some interesting things about this person. Notably, that the Times Live says that they have linked her to an organization within the Chinese Communist Party called the United Front Work Department. So, Terence, let me start with you. What should we make of this? Is there anything here, or is this just sort of people picking on her because she's Chinese? What's your take on this?
Well, interesting thing. I'm pleased to say I had the story first. When she was put into Parliament, there was a barrage of abuse from our Twitter warriors, mostly sort of ethno-chauvinistic, what's a Chinese person doing here? And I defended her on that, but I did point out that apparently the ANC had flagged her some time ago as being compromised and therefore unsuitable for to hold public office. The Integrity Committee is known for its dogged reach and its jagged jaws. And as I said, for a country with the kind of problems that we have, surely her place of birth and ethnographic origin should be of very, very slender importance. But if even the ANC could see a problem, then maybe that's something to be talking about. Now, apparently the story around her had to do with corruption. We don't know the details. We don't know if there's any substance to this. As far as the sort of influence of the Chinese Communist Party goes, well, that probably requires more work, but certainly the Chinese state is known for trying to use ethnic Chinese and its diaspora to advance its interests. In fact, it's something that a lot of people of Chinese ancestry who work for foreign governments or foreign interests find when they visit China, that they are sort of expected and cajoled into demonstrating their loyalty to their ancestral motherland. You may have 4 or 5 generations difference. You may not speak Chinese, but you are still. There is still this sort of expectation that your ancestry will trump everything. And perhaps what the Chinese do have here is that, you know, it's a large ancient civilization. It's very distinct, often, very distinct cultural frames of reference from the societies in which Chinese people, might migrate to. And, there's a sense that you can leverage that. And I think in many Western countries, the stress on race and ethnicity as an indelible marker, almost, you know, tribal loyalty is trumping everything, give this a certain legitimacy. Now, whether this applies to her, I don't think the last word has been said, but there is a certain playbook here that would suggest it's not beyond the realms of possibility.
So what's quite interesting to me is this United Front Work Department, which I must be honest, I had never heard about until now. But it's described in this investigation as having a bigger budget than the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and was described by the Australian Strategic Policy Institute as something that cooperates closely with China's spy agencies. It's also reportedly involved in setting up patronage networks and contacts for China throughout Africa. So I think it is pretty damning if they can connect it to it, although I think it's still probably a bit inconclusive.
I think with something like that, there are probably sort of gradations of involvement. The Chinese, let's just be clear, not the only country to do this. The CIA has been known to set up front organizations. I think all intelligence services worthy of their salt do it. I think the Chinese have a very, very aggressive proponents of this. The Confucius Institutes, you know, sort of present themselves as educational. They've actually been booted out of Sweden now because the Swedes, you know, who we know to be a famously restrained people, have said no, these guys are getting up to too much mischief. Certainly, they in Australia, which I think has been a major target of Chinese intelligence work. In all manner of ways, so to some extent through assets in the diaspora. There's a big Chinese community there, but also directly into Australian political parties through people who have no ethnic or even particularly ideological connection to China, but you know can be swayed in one way or another. And as I say, the Chinese seem to be quite adept at doing this, and they seem to understand target societies very well. You know, weaponizing wokeness, for instance, is a Chinese innovation of the last year. They take a lot of trouble to get to know their opponents. It's quite possible that she might in some way be involved without being fully aware of her involvement. But yes, you know, I do think that there are troubling questions raised here.
So, Marius, you were talking before the show about how this wouldn't be the first time that people have accused an MP of being an agent for China. You said something about there were some other countries that have had this problem. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, there are two actually MPs in New Zealand, both people who were born in China and moved to New Zealand in their fairly early adulthood, their 20s or early 30s. And they both turned out to, I'm not sure if they were actually found to actually be Chinese assets, but there was a lot of smoke. And I think both of them resigned from their positions as New Zealand MPs just to, you know, stop any kind of investigation into them. And there's also something that almost comes out of a thriller novel. Terence was mentioning Australia now. And a man, a Chinese-Australian man. He was he's from China, but he moved to Australia, whatever age he was. He was he owned a luxury car dealership. His name was Nick Zhao. And he approached the Australian intelligence agency to let them know that the Chinese government had approached him and asked him to run to become an MP for the Liberal Party in Australia. And then a couple of weeks later, Mr. Zhao was found dead in a hotel room in Melbourne, I think. So as far as I know, nobody's been identified as the murderer, whatever the case is. But, I mean, this does make you raise your eyebrows and, you know, who knows what the story is there. But definitely seems that the Chinese government is in some ways trying to, you don't want to call it a fifth column, but, I mean, that's almost what it is in some ways, in places that call their ideological adversaries. And, you know, there's lots of reasons people will spy on their home country. I mean, might be ideological issues. That's often why Americans used to spy for the Soviet Union. Might just be money. That's also why some Americans used to spy for the Soviet Union, or vice versa, whatever the case is. And also now we see these ties of ethnicity, and that could also, you know, be a reason why people of Chinese origin who were born in China decide to, you know, they might not actually have feel very strongly about the Chinese Communist Party, might actually dislike it, but they have some kind of, you know, feel they need to support their ethnic brethren in China. But just one point on this, though. I mean, I don't think the Chinese Communist Party or the Chinese government has to actually work to place any assets in the South African government or the South African parliament. We've seen the way South Africa talks about China, you know, and it seems to hold up the Chinese Communist Party and the model that they have there's when you have some kind of a model. So I think that the Chinese government's wasting its money by trying to get any MPs into ANC. I mean, they could probably just send some of Ramaphosa a WhatsApp and ask him what the South African government's up to the next couple of weeks, and they'll probably get, you know, a flood of information. So I don't think the Chinese government has to work too hard to find out what our government's up to.
No, exactly. Yeah, so Terence, I think just your final thoughts on this. It really does look to me like we're seeing a repeat of the Cold War now. Just as during the Cold War, there were intelligence agencies, American and Soviet, infiltrating agencies, countries around the world and governments around the world and trying to sway them. It looks like the world is setting up for another big geopolitical clash between the US and China. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's very true, and I agree 100% with Marius. A couple of years ago, the ANC had a document on various policy issues in the section of foreign affairs. Probably the most obsequious thing to come out of post 1994 South Africa, we regard the Communist Party of China as the lodestar of our struggle and most wonderful chaps and capital fellows and whatever. So yes, I doubt even being a sort of registered asset of China in South Africa would be career limiting. But we are seeing things hotting up in that part of the world. Just last week, there were reports that Japan had asked the United States for its war planning in respect of Taiwan. This has always been a big question mark. What would Japan do in that event? Japanese foreign policy has traditionally, well, since World War II, has traditionally been very pacifist. And one of the wild cards is would Japan allow American forces to use its territory in the event of that conflict? This suggests that Japan could actually be going, could actually be steaming towards actively committing itself to Taiwan's defense. You know, despite the fact that they have no formal diplomatic links, they're very close economic and even political ties between Japan and Taiwan. And Japan sees Taiwan's security as very much aligned to itself. So yes, you know, if things do start to accelerate there, the end point could be very, very hard to predict. I think, unfortunately, in that sort of Cold War, South Africa has chosen its side very volubly, audibly, and I think unenviably.
Yeah, well, as far as I'm concerned, we've definitely chosen the wrong side in that conflict. But anyway,
guys, also remember, I don't think the Chinese and the Americans are falling over themselves to, you know, get South Africa on board. It's not like it was during the Cold War or whatever, where I think we're a bit more important strategically. So I don't think we'd make if World War III kicks off, I don't think South Africa, you know, South Africa won't be. I mean, that's one advantage to be living. Yeah, I don't think we're going to be in the firing line at all.
I think you do underestimate the not the importance of our state and our country per se, but our we do have quite a lot of useful resources, and of course we are strategically positioned on the bottom of the African continent,
yeah, where
the major shipping lane.
If the shooting war starts with that involves Iran somehow, then I think the Cape of Good Hope will obviously become much more important than it is right now.
No, anyway, something to keep an eye on. So we now go to Richards Bay, where I'm sure some people have heard about the story, but basically one of the world's biggest companies, Rio Tinto, biggest mining companies, has decided to declare its contracts null and void with regards to Richards Bay Minerals, which is a sand mining operation. And this is following the week this is in the week following the murder of Richards Bay Minerals operations GM Nico Swart, who was concerned that there's been lots of drama around the mine, with local groups demanding that they get a share in the mining operation, and it's suspected that the murder of Nico Swart is connected to those demands. The DA's shadow minister for mines, who, full disclaimer, is my father, James Lorimer, says that the police need to set up a specialized police unit to crack down on mine invasions and Zama-Zama activity, and he pointed to several other examples of where this has happened around the country, for example, in Prisca in the Northern Cape, where the copper mine there had a similar thing happen. Local people, claiming to be local community members, but quite obviously having some outside involvement, showed up in the town, basically heavily armed, and said, "You give us a cut of the mine or else there's going to be trouble." So let me start with you again, Terence. Your thoughts on how this is happening, what's going on, what needs to be done to stop it. Is my father right to call for a specialized police unit to crack down on this stuff?
Look, I think that it's an expression of general sort of lawlessness throughout throughout the country. We've seen these syndicates operating, particularly around construction, but we have reason to believe that they've kind of jumped the fence there. I've been told that similar things are happening in the agricultural sector, in manufacturing. I think the COVID outbreak has given rise to all sorts of wild theories. One source of mine told me that rumors are being spread that the government has given all this money to businesses to employ people. So you assemble people, you take your commission, you know, to introduce them to the boss. You show up with a crowd, and you know, of course, there's no work waiting, but you then direct the anger at the factory owner or the manager, who's obviously just stolen all the money. And of course, you know, we have plenty of precedent in South Africa for stolen money, so that's a very it's a believable story. Mining, yeah, you know, we have mineral resources, we have potentially large flows of money, and companies that you know, have to, you know, would like to get them, would like to get those minerals out of this particular spot. So the heat you can put on them is, I think, just escalated that much. Our mining sector has been in decline, so this is obviously very very concerning. As for the suggestion of getting a specialized unit, well, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with that, but I think your specialized units have to come off a professional law enforcement system, and I think that's the problem. The basic foundations have been weakened to an extent that you say, well, you know, where exactly are you going to draw these people from? And by doing that,
right?
Do you,
well,
you know, do,
I guess
do you weaken what exists?
Yeah, exactly. I think the devil is in the details on that one, and that the key would be to draw the specialized unit from perhaps outside the saps.
Right. Yeah. I think there certainly is the moment for innovative thinking. So, yes, I would. I think it's something to explore.
Marius, your thoughts on this? It looks like South Africa is increasingly being mafiaized in pretty much every sphere at this point, particularly outside of the cities. Do you think this is a trend that's really going to continue? Or do you think the government will be forced to deal with this because it might at some point possibly interrupt the ANC's patronage networks? I mean, one would argue that I think some of the patronage networks are involved in these things already. But there could come a point where it becomes a little bit more disruptive. What do you think?
Yeah, I think probably the only way we're going to see any tough action is if the ANC's patronage networks get disrupted. But this is all part of the breakdown of the state and failure of governance. I mean, Richards Bay or Richards Bay Minerals isn't the first place this is happening. It's not going to be the last place. I mean, two places come to mind, or more than that, actually. I mean, there was Clover in Lichtenburg now. Decided to move his operations to Durban or Itegwini because the municipality is just so poorly run that they can't even transport their goods anymore because the roads are so bad. Down in Maltino in the Eastern Cape, there's an Omar Rusk's factory. They also decided they're going to move as well because the road is so bad to the factory that the Rusks get jumbled around so badly in the back of the truck that they break. So by the time they get to Tani Machta or whatever in Krugersdorp, Omar Rusk is broken. So she's obviously not happy about that. There's also in Standerton, I think it was, there was a chicken factory that also had to take the municipality to court because they weren't supplying water. So, yeah, this kind of thing is going to carry on happening. I mean, this is just a different example. Other places being because of the collapse of service delivery. Yeah, the collapse of the state. I mean, we've had this discussion before. One of the only, if we talk about the Night Watchman state and we talk about a stripped down state, one of its only responsibilities is to have a monopoly on force. And our state, which is anything but a Night Watchman state, doesn't even have that. That tells you something about the capability of our state and what's happening in the union buildings.
No, that's exactly right. And I think this is the great threat to South Africa's well-being, is once you kind of get people taking over the country with kind of mafias and armed groups and that kind of thing, then we could very quickly spiral into kind of chaos and little groups fighting each other, that kind of thing, as we see in places like DRC and the Central African Republic.
This is all because of an economy that's not working for everybody.
Right.
If down in Richards Bay, if there was an unemployment rate of 10%, you know, and most people had a job doing whatever cases they were, you know, working
exactly
in shops or, you know, or working in factories, or if they had the support to open little businesses, whatever the case is, this would not be happening. But because that doesn't,
yeah, no,
I mean, most of these people who are involved in this, or not maybe most, but a lot of people involved in this aren't evil people. I just think they're very desperate. And for a lot of people, you know, when you need to put food on your table or food on the table, then your morals may not be as strong as would be in other circumstances.
At the very least, as Terence pointed out, there's an opportunity here for unscrupulous individuals to exploit that desperation to kind of create groups and mobs and that kind of thing. And I think
that's what's happening in Kandla with a former head of state.
Yes, as we are seeing right now. And of course, you know, when a mining company like this moves out, it doesn't need to be it explained fully, but it really does hurt the people in the area. People lose jobs. The industries that support those workers then also go bust. And of course, the state loses more tax revenue, which is something it really can't afford to do right now, considering how deep of a financial hole we're in.
14,000 people are employed by Richards Bay Minerals. So 14,000. Yeah, exactly. Let's be conservative. Say they support two people each. 14,000 times three. That's 50,000 people now are going to be without income.
Right. Exactly. And I think the most shocking thing about this was after the murder of Nico Swart, there was a press statement from Mining Minister Gwede Mataše, which basically said something along the lines of, and I am paraphrasing here, guys, don't kill mining managers. It's bad, okay? Which was so weak and so mad, like as though you have to say murder is bad. It's just it's very good at explaining the state, how we got to the state.
No, it's quite funny.
We have the state we do.
It's not funny actually, but I mean, if you're not going to laugh, you're going to cry.
Yeah, it's darkly humorous.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to our last story for today, and that is a rather, I don't know what to call it, a spicy story coming out from Swaziland. So as we've been talking about recently, there's been a drama going on in Swaziland. What many people may not know is that the Economic Freedom Fighters, Julius Malema's party, has multiple branches across Southern Africa. Various Southern African countries all have their own version of the EFF. There's one in Namibia. I think there's one in Botswana. It also turns out to be one in Swaziland.
And there's one in Zimbabwe. Well,
yeah. The Eswatini government has said to SADC, that is the South African Development Community, which is the regional body that all the Southern African countries belong to, that there are guns being smuggled from South Africa into Eswatini that are being used to kill its citizens. And they say that these guns are coming from the EFF in South Africa and being given to its sister organization, the EFF of Swaziland. However, the EFF in Eswatini has vigorously denied these allegations, saying that they're garbage. There's apparently video evidence showing Eswatini military has been shooting people since the uprising against the king began last week. And, of course, the EFF in Eswatini is actually illegal according to the laws of Swaziland, because Swaziland has banned all political parties since 1973. Marius, should we put any stock in this? I wouldn't say the Eswatini government is the world's most credible organization, but I also wouldn't say that the EFF is the kind of group that wouldn't do something like this.
No, I mean, exactly. I remember a couple of years ago there were photos of an EFF branded Bucky driving around this. I can't remember where the protests were, but it was EFF branded Bucky driving around with tires on the back of it to protest so these could be lit on fire. So we all know that the EFF aren't the biggest fans of the rule of law. I mean, you know, they flip-flop on the issue all the time, and, you know, they're fans of the rule of law in the courts when it suits them, and otherwise they're not. I mean, this is a very big allegation, and it definitely needs to be investigated further. But I wouldn't be surprised if it's not true, but I also wouldn't be surprised if it is true. And if it is true, this is dangerous escalation by Julius Malema and the EFF. And I mean, then really, who knows if anything would happen there, but then really the book needs to be thrown at them. You know, running guns and stuff is not something a political party should be doing. And the situation in Eswatini is dire at the moment, but I don't think it helps if opposition groups are being sent weapons from South Africa. I mean, things need to be de-escalated there in Swaziland. You know, people need to come to the negotiating table. I do think it's time for King Mswati and Swazi royal family to at least look at some reforms and move away from being an absolute monarchy. But violence is not going to be the answer, and I hope things get resolved there with, you know, not with the minimum level of violence and more bloodshed. But, I mean, this is also, that's up to the king. He's got to, you know, decide now it's time for reform of his country, and South Africa needs to, you know, put as much pressure on them as possible without, as I say, without resorting to violence or anything like that.
Oh, exactly. Terence, in 60 seconds or so, your final thoughts on this topic.
Eswatini, reform long overdue. I think that what you probably want there is for the Eswatini authorities to indicate where these shootings happened. You know, I think that's the first thing to explain. If they have captured any kind of ordnance, then you can trace the you could trace the origin through serial numbers and things like that. Now, it's not foolproof, but that may give some indication of the origins and how they could have ended up there. Agree with Marius. It sort of fails the smell test, but not entirely.
Indeed, I think it definitely needs to be investigated and taken quite seriously, because it's exactly the kind of thing that causes very bad things to happen. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today on this anarchy-filled episode of the Daily Fringe Show. We hope you enjoyed. please like us, subscribe to us, share the video, tell your friends, tell the world if you like the show. And we'll see you tomorrow for the next episode of the Daily Friend Show. Have a great day, everyone.